Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 29th, 2024. While Israel answered last Friday's International Court of Justice order, it halt its military assault on the Rafah government in the southern Gaza Strip and reopen the Rafah border with scores of aerial bombings over the weekend, one of which immolating refugees in one of the myriad tent encampments surrounding the besieged city of Rafah. Hellscape phone images of the aftermath of that horror have spurred hope Western sponsors and suppliers of scofflaw Israel will either voluntarily or through the political force of their democratic constituents quit their material support, without which the carnage cannot continue. Eve Engler is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 13 books, including Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid. His latest, co-authored with Owen Schalk, is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, which he's currently touring across the country. Eve's also a prolific essayist whose writing appears across the internet and at his website, eveengler.com, where I found his recent piece, Ironically, Genuine Internationalism Must Be Nationalistic. Eve Engler in the first half. And We Go to Bed in Horror and Awake to Horror is how Al Jazeera journalist Leila El-Aryan describes the churning, directed catastrophe inflicted on Palestinians. Though she refers here to reports of Israeli bulldozers desecrating the cemeteries of Jabalia refugee camp in the north the day after the Log Bomber massacre in Rafah, she could say the same every day, any day, in these long months and years of death and cruelty in Gaza and in the occupied territories beyond the wall. But essential journalist Jonathan Cook transcends the banality of the occupation's everyday brutality in describing Israel's Bagram, Sadeh Taman. Cook's article, The Message of Israel's Torture Chambers, is directed at us all, not just Palestinians, is a portrait immediately familiar to any who've studied the Nazi camps and especially students of the medical atrocities of Dr. Joseph Mengele. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where I found his latest, Ending Israel's Impunity for Genocide in Gaza and the Threat to Those, like Joe Biden, who are most complicit. Andy Worthington and Nuremberg's to come in the second half. But first, Eve Engler and Canada's time to stand finally strong and free. Welcome back to the program, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, firstly, Eve, we'll reiterate this at the end here, but you're getting on the road again pretty soon, bound for the glorious West. Among your other stops, now, what's the itinerary?
The 9th in Nanaimo, Parksville and Courtney, and then in Duncan, Denman the next day, and then on the 11th in Victoria and Vancouver on the 12th.
Can you give us a thumbnail of the book?
Yeah, the book is basically the history of Canada helping to oust elected governments. We list more than 20 examples since the early 1950s. And that goes from, probably the worst one, Haiti in 2004, to Lumumba in Congo in the early 60s, to more passive support for coups against Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran. And so it details that. So it's historical in that sense. And of course, that history is important in terms of judging Canadian foreign policy today, because they often talk about how we support democracy around the world, or we oppose China and Russia because they are authoritarian governments. But when you look at the history of Canada backing the ouster of elected governments, it puts a little bit of doubt into that claim that our aim is to support or to oppose authoritarianism, and that's why we're in competitions with countries like China and Russia. So it's a historical look at, I think it obviously upends the overarching mythology out there that Canadian governments, including this current one of Justin Trudeau, that they, you know, view democracy as centrally important to their international objectives. They don't. The current government has backed a coup in Bolivia, 2019, more recently, maybe more passively in Peru, and then in Venezuela, unsuccessfully, but they, you know, went to quite extensive lengths to try to overthrow a government there. So the book, I think, really pokes a big hole in the mythology and the points out just how hypocritical Canadian foreign policy is when it comes to rhetoric around democracy.
Yeah, not to mention Honduras and Chile way back when. Your recent article that I mentioned in the introduction, ironically, genuine internationalism must be nationalistic. Well, the elephant in the Canadian living room has always been our cousins down south. Is there such a thing as Canadian policy or Canadian nationalism independent of the United States? I mean, is there any there?
There's a little bit there. It doesn't need to be that way. It is, of course, heavily influenced by Washington's objectives. It doesn't need to be that way. And there is a minimum theoretical independence. And if you look at other countries like Mexico, which are actually more economically dependent on the U.S. than Canada is, they happen to have much more independent foreign policies. They are not joining every NATO mission. They are even actually, Mexico, even joining to join South Africa's case against Israel of genocide at the International Court of Justice. So it isn't something that's preordained. It doesn't have to be this way. But in current politics, of course, Canada's foreign policy is intimately connected to Washington's and is highly subservient. That piece that you point out, that you mentioned, that I wrote, it's a response to some of the Zionist genocide promoters' bid to deflect from the horrible crimes that Israel's committing in Gaza by saying, well, why aren't these student encampments also focused on specifically on the rapid support forces in Sudan's attacks against people in Darfur and eastern Sudan, and calling them the Islamist militias? And so they basically want to say, well, you're protesting what Israel's doing. They're implying in this case that because you're anti-Semitic or you're anti-Jewish or you have some other ulterior reason than being appalled by the criminality of it all. But the point of my piece is just to say, well, this obvious response to that is that, well, you know, Canada is deeply involved in every facet of Israel's crimes, be it in giving, you know, selling weapons, be it in diplomatic support, where Melanie Joly has made multiple what she calls solidarity missions to Israel, be it this incredible sums of money that's being subsidized by all taxpayers to charities in Israel, including those supporting the Israeli military. A couple of weeks ago, you had a bunch of Canadian cities raising Israel's flag as it's committing a Holocaust in Gaza. None of that, of course, is going on with regards to what's a major human rights tragedy in Sudan, no doubt about it. It's there's no doubt there's tons of crimes taking place there. But Canada is not engaged in it. And so the point of my piece is to say, we actually shouldn't, contrary to what some people sort of imply, and including people on the left, when they respond to some of these Zionist activists bid to deflect away from Israel's crimes, we should be open that we aren't actually concerned about international crimes kind of in an equal way. We're not. We are concerned, you know, on a personal level. We may, you know, have our, I obviously, you know, follow the horrors going on in Sudan and other places that I'll very rarely comment on, because Canada is not really engaged. It's not really responsible. And so we should be focusing not just on some sort of abstract, we're concerned about all injustice everywhere at the same time, but rather what injustice is our government, is our political system, political culture responsible for? And more importantly, what can we upend? how can we help to lessen the crimes? How can we alleviate the injustice, etc.? So that's part of what I'm arguing in that piece. But also then the kind of alongside that is that, in fact, it's the deflection itself, right? It's the fact that there is this whole movement to deflect from Israel's crimes in Canada. That is precisely the argument for the student encampments. It's because we don't, that the same dynamic doesn't play out when it comes to Sudan. If you criticize the Rapid Support Forces killings in Sudan, people don't say, well, why don't you also criticize Israel's crimes? But in the case of Israel, you do have that. And you even have that. You have that in the mainstream media, in the dominant media. So the deflection itself is the proof, if you like, of the need to have these student encampments to challenge, because there is a political force, a political movement in our country that itself is engaged in this deflection, and we obviously need to counter that. So the point being that so long as we live in a nationalist structured world, genuine internationalism, in fact, needs to be paradoxically nationalistic, i.e. restraining Canada's contributions to different international injustices.
You finished the essay as you're describing, but as per internationalism, you say it's immoral to focus on international crimes equally. Instead, our focus should be on how our government society contributed to a particular international wrongdoing, and what's our leverage to make change? Well, can I just clarify, what does it mean to be an internationalist?
Genuine internationalism is about undermining that, or to subverting that order that's deeply unequal. You know, in the case of Israel Palestine, I mean, it's just in our face. Just so our media is just it doesn't hide how much it prioritizes the lives of Israelis over Palestinians. And maybe one of the most egregious examples that we see that is that you hear endless talk about the hostages, they got to kill everyone in Gaza because there's hostages, Israeli hostages. Well, 9,000 Palestinians have been kidnapped by Israel over the past 7.5 months. So we talk about the 240 or whatever, and now 100 or 20 or whatever the number is exactly in Gaza that are the Israel's hostages that Hamas and or other Palestinian groups hold, but we don't hear anything, and those hostages justify endless killing and starvation policy and the like, and yet we don't hear about the hostages of what's that about 80 times more hostages that Israel has. And of course, Israel, the hostages that the occupying power, the apartheid state, takes of, I would say, in fact, are is much more immoral than the hostages that a resistance force takes. So, and including the fact that most of the Israelis that are in Gaza are Israeli soldiers. It's just a few days ago there was images that came out of these Israeli women that were captured by Hamas, and all the propagandists for Israel just try to ignore the fact that these were Israeli soldiers that were manning, or in this case, womening the towers that were enclosing the Gaza prison. That those who busted out on October 7th, the first time in their lives for most of them that they ever got outside of the Gaza prison. So this kind of thing is just, it's so egregious. I would call it so egregiously anti-internationalist focus, prioritization. So yeah, so in terms of, I think concretely in terms of what's going on in Palestine and Gaza, what internationalism means for people who are in Canada, it means undercutting the innumerable forms of support that Canada has and continues to provide to the state that is unleashing unspeakable horrors in Gaza.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eve Angler. Eve's a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 13 books, including Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid. I've got that right in front of me, and it's going to be gifted soon. Eve is going to bring copies of that very book that was written about a century ago, it seems now, given the latest things going on. His latest book is co-authored with Owen Schalk. It is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. He's currently on tour, about to get out the door, as we were just describing. Can you reiterate, Eve, again, your Western dates for our listeners in this area?
Yeah, so I'm going to be on the island, Vancouver Island, from the 9th to the 11th, Nanaimo, Parksville, Courtney, Duncan, Denman Island, Victoria on the 11th. Then in Vancouver, then I'm going to be in Kelowna, Calgary, and then Regina and Winnipeg towards the latter half of June.
Well, and then again for our SFU listeners, that's the 12th of June in Vancouver. The universities you mentioned, you've got another, your more recent article up at eveangler.com is Behind the Scenes of Canadian Universities' Ties to Israel. I mean, there's one thing about how Canadian foreign policy is manipulated by our friends south and by Israel, too, to a huge degree as well. How about how policies within the country are interfered with from these same forces? And we're seeing this as a side note to what's going on at the universities. What are your thoughts on the way academics and students here are threatened by foreign serving interests within this country?
Yeah, well, the first thing on the student stuff is that this is a remarkable student uprising. That what we've seen, you know, almost 20 university campuses with these student encampments calling for divestment, calling for breaking of ties between their universities, Israeli universities, and of course at a kind of more macro level, just opposing Canada's complicity in Israel's genocide. Now, the fact that the administrations at these universities take such a hard line stand against things that some of the demands that are actually pretty minimal, right? Like stopping investments in arms companies selling weapons to Israel. Like, so McGill has $500,000 in stock of Lockheed Martin, which is the producer of the F-35, one of the fighter jets that's been, you know, killing Palestinians in Gaza. So that's not a particularly big demand. That, you know, that's not, shouldn't be that controversial to sell that stock. There's been lots of divestment campaigns at universities on many different issues, climate questions, prisons, all kinds of stuff. And universities have conceded. McGill just conceded on fossil fuel companies not that long ago. Now, the student movement did have to protest for quite a while to get that demand. But so that's not that. But I think when it comes to Israel, we have to be clear that there's sort of like two dimensions to it. One is you have the macro of these universities are establishment. They are capitalistic. They are part of Canadian imperial kind of thinking. And so on all, you know, foreign policy issues, they just have a sort of de facto kind of allied with the overarching Canadian imperial viewpoint, be that from Haiti, be that on the NATO proxy war, on and on and on. And so that exists in all these universities now. But on top of that, when it comes to the question of Palestine, is that you have very committed Zionist, overwhelmingly Jewish donors to these universities that are very hostile to Palestinian rights. And many of the relationships between the McGill's the one where I've looked at it most closely, the relationship between McGill and Israeli universities, those didn't just drop from the sky, but in fact, those were financed by donors who are staunch supporters of Israel. And so the demand that the students are making, one of the demands the students are making about cutting these ties, runs right up against this donor class that is provided, you know, tens, hundreds even of millions of dollars. And so the administrations are exceedingly hostile to conceding because they are being told behind the scenes, and not just behind the scenes, but you know, Anthony Helsfather, the liberal MP, the arch Zionist liberal MP, stated it very clearly about withdrawing funding to universities that are, he frames it as, you know, not combating anti-Semitism enough, but that really means just, you know, standing against genocide. So the university administrations have on one hand this, they're part of their, you know, established order, pro-imperial, and then on top of that you have a very committed, wealthy sector that's staunchly supportive of Israel, and so they're not willing to concede beyond the most minimal demands. Even though, you know, at McGill now, it's on today's day 33 of this student encampment at the university. So this is you know, people have, and then before that there was the hunger strike. The students were on hunger strike for 60 days. Two of them went to the hospital, and that's after in November there was a vote where 78.7% of undergrads in the highest turnout in the Student Society of McGill University's history of referendums, the highest turnout, they voted for the a resolution calling for basically divestment. So you at this point it's clear the student body, it's absolutely crystal clear the support for the demands is overwhelming. Then beyond the student body, of many petitions that have been signed by hundreds and hundreds of faculty and staff of the university. So you really do have this situation where it's the administration of the university versus the opinion of most of the those who make up the university. And the explanation of that is, again, the combination of the overarching establishment pro-imperial and the influence of donors.
Well, Heidi Matthews, she's an instructor at York at Osgoode Hall, the law school there. And she has been working with others, and I don't know if that they coined this term, but there is a term now new to the dictionary, new to the English language, scholasticide. This describes the utter destruction by Israel of all the universities, not only the universities, all of the universities in Gaza, but all the other schools, the elementary schools, the UN schools. The targeting of teachers, the assassination of professors and administrators, basically a scorched earth on the whole idea of teaching generally. Now, if that's not enough to bring schools here and universities into some form of allegiance with those, their compatriots or their colleagues in Gaza and Palestine, I don't know what else is, but you don't hear much about that in our regular press. But to go the long way around now, even your article, Behind the Scenes of Canadian Universities' Ties to Israel, you talk about the way that Israel's universities within Israel, as well as being involved with Canadian universities here in various programs, are heavily involved with the military within Israel, and assist in what that military is doing in Gaza and in other areas too. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
I mean, the first thing, this has been something that's been a bit viewed as controversial for a number of years since the sort of academic boycott of Israel became sort of on the scenes. I guess now it's almost 15 years ago. And there's a sort of claim out there that these Israeli universities are these, you know, bastions of liberalism, and they're the, you know, hub of opposition to Netanyahu and stuff like that. And that's just it's not. I mean, there's truths within there, but overarching, that's just not correct.
This ain't Berkeley.
Yeah, and to the point where, like, they actually had a pause for 3 months until basically into the new year. All the Israeli universities paused so reservists could go and kill in Gaza. And then they came to an agreement with the Israeli military about restarting classes, and the military wanted to, you know, protect the interests of the 50, I think Haaretz said it was 58,000 reservists that were either students or faculty at universities. And so they came to this agreement to sort of protect their interests while, you know, classes restarted. And so that's just at the kind of macro level that these Israeli universities are involved in the war machine. But then if you get going into details on the different universities, and this has been going on for decades and decades, where they have like really elaborate programs, contracts with the Israeli military, one Hebrew university training IDF intelligence officers, and they live in special residence, only accessible to military, these students do, on campus. Other ones like Technion, they boast about producing remote-controlled bulldozer that's the U.S. or the IDF, the Israeli military, is used to demolish Palestinian homes. They boast about producing this thing called a scream, the crazy loud sounds to basically terrorize people that the Israeli military uses. So Israeli universities, that this whole, like, you know, it's considered kind of like outside of bounds, this really extreme demand that these student encampments are making to for McGill to cut its ties to Technion or Hebrew University. That's kind of how it's framed, even by somewhat sympathetic, like the CBC, which are, you know, become sort of somewhat sympathetic to the encampments. They're kind of like, oh yeah, we're on board for, you know, divesting of Lockheed Martin stock. That seems like an okay, that we can kind of support that. But they don't say anything sort of positive, and often say negative things about cutting ties to Israeli universities. But these Israeli universities have shown that if you delve into the details, they are clearly helping the Israeli military general level, in that they you know, went on pause for 3 months so reservists could go kill in Gaza. But also, this has been going on for decades and decades, where the universities are producing both you know, individuals, they're assisting the training of soldiers, and they are producing equipment for the Israeli military.
Well, yeah, the devil is in the details, and what a devil it is, too. Behind the scenes of Canadian universities' ties to Israel, you can find that at eveangler.com. Eve, we're fast out of time. I've got Andy Worthington coming up in a minute. We're going to talk about he's done work on Gitmo for years, and we're going to talk about Sidi Taman, this grotesque prison arrangement going on even beyond your worst dreams of Gitmo and Bagram prisons that the Americans ran during their wars. But Eve, reiterate finally, one more time, your appearance is out here, out west.
I'll be on the island on Sunday, June 9th, Nanaimo, Parksville, Courtney, June 10th in Denman Island, Duncan, June 11th in Victoria in the evening, June 12th in Vancouver, and then moving towards the prairies beginning on June 14th.
Well, we look forward to seeing you once again. And you bring money to these things to buy some of Eve's books, because he's got a lot of them, and you'll not find anything like it anywhere else. I can guarantee you that. Thanks again for coming on, Eve.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Stay tuned for Andy after the break.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, we go to bed in horror and awake to horror is how Al Jazeera journalist Leila Al-Aryan describes the churning, directed catastrophe inflicted on Palestinians, though she refers here to reports of Israeli bulldozers desecrating the cemeteries of Jabalia refugee camp in the north the day after the Lag Bomer massacre in Rafah. She could say the same any day, every day, in these long years of death and cruelty in Gaza and in the occupied territories beyond the wall. But essential journalist Jonathan Cook transcends the banality of the occupation's everyday brutality in describing Israel's Bagram, Sade Taman. Cook's article, The Message of Israel's Torture Chambers, is directed at us all, not just Palestinians, is a portrait immediately familiar to any who have studied the Nazi camps, and especially students of the medical atrocities of Dr. Joseph Mengele. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Forefathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo File,